Spent 5 days in Ghana on this trip. Sabbath before the Passover, Passover, night to be much observed, and then the first holy day. The Sabbath in between was in Owerri, and the final day was in Benin City, where our congregations are. Congregation in Accra is 25, Owerri is 40, Benin's 30, Lagos is 50, 60, in that range. None of them are large congregations in this sense. With a little bit of excitement, when we were in Owerri, as we were coming into church, Dari got a call and he stepped outside and didn't come in very quickly, but that morning there had been a fire in the church hall in Lagos. The hall in Lagos is an apartment in a building, a three-story building. We're on the top floor. We have half of the top floor. Apartment is not an ideal place to meet for church. It's all we've got. And so we've opened up the best we can. Dari has an office he uses there as well. The fire is in the apartment next to our hall, and there were two children in the apartment alone at the time, 7 and 4. And the fire was by the front where they could not get out the door. Some of the young men that were setting up for services figured out, understood at some point what was happening, and they literally were able to rescue the children because you could not go through the door. You had to go somehow over the top or outside and bring the children out. If the children would not have been rescued, they would have had to jump from the third floor down to concrete. And they're fine. The apartment was burnt up. Dari's office there, the ceiling is gone and the walls cracked and some of it's burnt. But they did, fire department did come. They actually brought equipment. Water. It's a laugh, but the fact is they don't always bring either, and it's not their tradition to bring water at all. And so the fact that they had water meant they could actually get it to the top and put the fire out, and the church hall was spared. The family actually moved right into the apartment and started cleaning up. That's how life is over there. And the congregation there went ahead with services. I'm sure it was a little smoky, but it just shows you it's a little different world, you know. It's inconvenient to have half your hall burned down, but that doesn't stop going to church. We have looked at ourselves historically as being part of the Philadelphian era of the church, Revelation 3. And we looked at the Sardis era before us as having lost knowledge that had to be restored. We looked at the Laodicean era after us as being in spiritual decline. Therefore, everybody obviously wanted to be Philadelphians, right? Nobody wanted to be a Sardisan. You know how long it took to come up with a name for Sardis? I asked a bunch of people what the plural of Sardis was, and they said, Sardinans. I said, no, that would be a sardine, that you've added a D, but Sardisans. Anyway, nobody wanted to be one of those. And they didn't want to be a Laodicean. They wanted to be Philadelphian. One lost knowledge, the other one became judgmental and self-righteous. We did acknowledge, though, that there were predominant characteristics in each of those eras and that any individual could represent those specific things. That it wasn't just everyone in one place doing one thing, but there was a dominant perspective, and then individual and specific response. I've never heard anyone say they felt like they were Ephesian or Thyatiran. I've never heard anyone say that. And if I've ever heard anyone give reference personally to being Laodicean, it was actually almost a badge of shame. They were trying to fire up and get back into the mainstream of the church. But those terms have been used. I would just say this, it is a bit dangerous for us to portray ourselves as one thing and everyone else as something else. Anyone who says that they are the only Philadelphians, by definition, are not. And there are people who do. Sardis or Philadelphia or Laodicea are not corporate terms. Look at Luke 18. Going back to those who say they are Philadelphian and that no one else could possibly be apart from them. But Luke 18 and verse number 9 is a parable that I think, gives pretty clear reference to what is represented. It says, he spoke this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous. I'd say that's Laodicea, pretty close to what's described. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee, the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood and prayed thus with himself, God, I thank you that I am not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even as this tax collector. I fast twice a week, I give tithes of all that I possess. And the tax collector, standing afar off, would not so much as raise his eyes to heaven, but beat his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. Everyone who exalts himself will be abased. Everyone who humbles himself will be exalted. Anyone who says that they are the only Philadelphians are just beating their own chest. And they will not be justified in that way. If you compare that to Revelation 3 and verse number 17, where the messages to the churches are recorded, Revelation 3:17 under Laodicea, it says, you say, I am rich, I have become wealthy, and have need of nothing. You do not know that you're wretched and miserable, poor, blind, and naked. Being self-righteous is Laodicean, not Philadelphian. Now, in regard to church errors or the characteristics that are portrayed there, there's something that we do need to understand in Revelation 3, and I'd like to walk through just one verse in each. Revelation 3:3, starting out with Sardis, notice what is referenced as their condition and also the timing of their portrayal or what is being portrayed. Revelation 3:3. Remember, therefore, how you have received and heard. Hold fast and repent. If you do not watch, I'll come upon you as a thief, and you will not know what hour I will come upon you. When it talks about coming as a thief, it is a warning about the return of Jesus Christ. And so the reference is being made to Sardis that they have to watch. Why? Because they are asleep. And they need to wake up, and they need to keep their eyes open, and Christ says, I am coming on you, and it's going to surprise you as if I was a thief because you're not looking. Okay, that's Sardis. But notice Christ says, I'm coming to you. So let's not assume in that sense that Sardis happens and goes away, Philadelphia happens and goes away, Laodicea comes and Christ returns. There are progressive elements of the eras. I believe that is true. There are also elements of the eras that are applicable to any who might be at any point in time. But the fact is, if you just look at the prophecies here, Sardis and Philadelphia and Laodicea all line up with the return of Jesus Christ. In that sense, they are contemporary, or elements of them are contemporary at the end. Revelation 3 and verse number 20, we're now talking about, well, let me go to number 11, Revelation 3:11. Now it's talking to Philadelphia. It says, behold, I come quickly. Hold fast what you have, that no one may take your crown. You could lose your crown if you slide off into Laodicea, or if you retrogress back into Sardis, and are susceptible to the faults that are expressed. But again, it's in the midst of this context, and then going on to verse number 20, where we have Laodicea described, it says, behold, I stand at the door and knock. And so on the one he says, I'm going to come to you and you're going to be surprised, and the other he says, I'm really coming very fast, and then he says, look, I'm knocking at the door. The fact is, elements of each line up with the return of Jesus Christ. Contemporary in some ways. I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come into him and dine with him and he with me. So it's important when we look at those eras that we at least recognize that elements of those eras are going to exist side by side right up until the end. One of the members in Ghana this year, it has been such a blessing for me to be able to go to Ghana and get to know members there and see their background. what I've learned, what's opened up to me to understand what God is doing is, to me, rather dramatic. One of the members in Ghana there is Stephen. And he came up to me on the night to be much observed. And frankly, I had not planned to keep the night to be much observed there. I had gone over with a ticket, and I would be there 3 days. Dari had made the ticket, and I would be returning back to Lagos for the night to be much observed and the first holy day. And when the members found out that I was not going to stay with them through the meal and then into the first day of the feast, they were disappointed. In fact, they were more than disappointed, they were distressed. And the member who drove me and that I spent some time with expressed to me how distressing the members were that they wanted me there. They wanted someone to be with them through those first part, at least, of those days. And so I was sitting there on the Sabbath, I suppose, before the Passover. And Bridget Sexton is actually working there. Now, that's amazing that you can sit there and be with Bridget. She's in Ghana, and I knew her here. But regardless, she made a comment. She says, well, when are you heading back? What do you think I said? I said, I don't know. I don't pay attention to things like, when do you get on a plane? I said, I don't know. I'm going back for the night to much observed. She says, well, when's your flight? I said, oh, I think it's in the afternoon. She said, I don't think so. What do you mean you don't think so? She said, can I see your flight schedule? Come on, you know, check my flights for me. I'm not home. But anyway, I said, okay. She said, well, you're flying not in the evening. She said, I know the schedule. I use those flights. They only have an early morning and an evening schedule. You're flying back during the night to be much observed. I says, oh, Dari made a mess. And she said, well, you can get it changed. And she explained to me at the airport where you go and you can go. So I go to the airport and I'm going to change my flight. Just figure get on the morning, it'll be okay. Morning was booked, not a seat. I said, well, okay, what can I do? Well, you can fly a business class. How much is that? You know, about $1 million. You know, you change the plane or change the ticket and then you pay for the business class. I wasn't going to spend that kind of money. And I said, well, maybe I need to go on the holy day. We'll have it in the afternoon. I said, well, how about the next day? Well, no, all those seats are taken too. I said, well, when do you have a seat? Well, it was the flight the evening after the first holy day, after the Sabbath was over. So I thought, okay, I'll just stay here and keep the days. And the members in Ghana go, yes, you know, I mean, they're, I don't know, they're praying for a disaster or something, you know, the plane won't get off the ground, and here I am. So we're sitting there at the dinner, and Stephen comes up to me, and he says, you know, it is our tradition on this night to reflect on our calling. I'm going, man, I feel like I'm talking to somebody from 30 years ago. I mean, that is our tradition, but it isn't so often commonly mentioned, even if among the younger set, because it's what we always have done, but it goes way, way back. And so he started telling me about how he was called into the church. He said, I was a Muslim, and I was exposed to Christianity, and I really liked what I heard. He said, what I liked was what I heard about Jesus Christ. Because you see, as a Muslim, who do you think he's comparing Jesus Christ to? To Muhammad. You know, Muhammad's out there with a sword, you know, chopping people up and marrying little girls. I'm not joking. I'm saying that is what you compare it to if you know the story. So he's a Muslim and he liked what he heard about Jesus Christ. His family didn't exactly embrace that for him. He had to leave home and move away and go somewhere else. He was a tailor and he did and he moved to Accra. He became a Christian, as the society there understood. And he walked into a church, and he sat down, and he looked around, and he listened to what was being taught. And he kind of, something he said was still missing. It wasn't quite right. And he went to the pastor, and he began to express his concerns to the pastor and what it is that he was looking for. And the pastor, this goes back into the 70s, the pastor handed him the Ten Commandments booklet from the church. He read the booklet, and he walked out the door. He says, this is the wrong place. And he wrote Bricket Wood on the back of the booklet. And then, you know who answered his letter? Mr. Rhodes. He was living in Accra. But the system was, you wrote the office, and then he answered, responded, and it came back. And so he ended up attending church right there in Accra, and Mr. Rhodes was his pastor. He said for him, those were the good years, got baptized, knew the truth, sat in the midst of God's people. The numbers were pretty good back then. You know, there was 400 people in Ghana in the Worldwide Church of God. There was over 2,000 people in Nigeria. Nigeria had the camps, and they had all the activities and the congregations and the pastors. It was great. It was very high years. But that didn't last. Eventually, Mr. Rhodes left. Other pastors came in and took over. Pastors that were Ambassador College trained. It took time to get them to college, get them through the system, get them back to Ghana, let them take over the congregations. So in time, things changed. Praise worship was instituted. Pentecostal music and dance. That was offensive to Stephen, and he simply stopped attending. Now, from his perspective, as far as he knew, there was nowhere else to go. He walked out the door. He said, as long as I had my holiday calendar, I kept the feast. He had that little pocket calendar that we have in our wallets, okay, or purse. And it only goes out so many years. He said, well, as long as it was on that calendar, I kept the feast. He said, when I ran out of dates on the calendar, it was like walking off the edge of the map. You know, there was nowhere left to go. And so the feast then kind of dissipated. But honestly, what was happening was he went to sleep spiritually. He wasn't being taught. He wasn't with the members, the brethren. He didn't have the focus being reinforced. It wasn't coming to him week by week. And he basically just went to sleep. Now look at Revelation 3 on Sardis in verse number 1. Read the passage here. Notice what it describes. The angel of the church in Sardis write, these things says he who has the seven spirits of God and the seven stars. I know your works, that you have a name that you're alive, but you're dead. Now, dead in this sense means dying, because it shows you have some things that remain. They're ready to die. I have not found your works perfect. So they were losing truth, okay? And they were down to what? Maybe they were down to just the remnant of the Sabbath, and not even keeping the Sabbath in the right way. It says, remember therefore how you have received and heard, hold fast and repent. If you will not watch, if you can't wake up, if you can't look and see what's happening, I will come on you as a thief, and you will not know what hour I will come upon you. You have a few names, even in Sardis, who have not defiled their garments. They shall walk with me in white, for they are worthy. He who overcomes shall be clothed in white garments. I'll not blot out his name from the book of life. I'll confess his name before my Father, before his angels. And it says, if you understand this, if you have an ear to hear, then listen to what the Spirit says to the churches. So here we have Stephen. In my mind, I'm listening to him and I'm going, you know, that's the most descriptive portrayal of Sardis I've ever personally heard. Because I tend to think in many respects in other terms. Well, Sardis is different than Laodicean, is it not? Sardis went to sleep. Laodicea didn't go to sleep. They're beating their chest. They're judging. They're lifting themselves up. They're saying, I'm doing great. It's not the same. Laodicea is a hypocrisy in some sense. It's a self-righteousness. It's being judgmental. It's looking down on those around you spiritually and not recognizing your own spiritual failure. In various ways, Stephen's story, though, is the story of the entire Accra congregation. The whole congregation now that remains went through that process in some way where they had the truth, then they had the watered-down truth, and then they had somebody teaching them error, and in the process, they're drifting off to sleep. Because they didn't come out of that group until the last straw. They sat through the praise worship, and they sat through all the offerings during services, and they sat through the women coming up and proclaiming their witness to the congregation, and they sat through the doctrines, and they sat there until someone says, you know what? we're not going to keep the Sabbath anymore. And they walked out the door. Now all 400 of the first group was effectively still remaining. And so the 25 who walked out are the ones who walked out kind of shaking their head going, oh, I've got to wake up. I've got to get back on focus here. Unfortunately, what they came into with the United Church of God was a group that now formed the core of who we were that had been the Remnant Church of God. And the Remnant Church of God did not have a Church of God background. There were men who took church literature and went out and began to proclaim the gospel in their areas, and they raised up a church that had Pentecostal origin and Pentecostal tradition, and they walked into the United Church of God en masse. The congregations came in together, the pastors of the congregations came in together, and I'll just say this, Mr. Rhodes did not do that. And Fred Keller said, don't do that. But it was done. So when they walked out of one group into the other, now the United Church of God, they're still singing and dancing in the aisles. And they were shaking their head going, am I able to wake up? Can I wake up? Is there anyone who will feed me? Now, this context played out. I'll tell you some of the story, but 1 Thessalonians 5 first. Scriptures that I used to look at in the Bible as clearly just talking about the last days, as I watch this sort out in Ghana and I understand now some of the background, I begin to look at them from the context of the fact that you've got Sardis, Philadelphia, and Laodicea, at least in character, existing side by side by side right up to the end. So some of the scriptures about the end are actually referencing primarily Sardis, and some are referencing primarily Philadelphia, and some Laodicea. It applies to all, but there's a predominant characteristic that is being addressed. You'll see it real clearly when I describe 1 Thessalonians 5. It says, concerning the times and the seasons, brethren, you have no need that I should write to you. You yourselves know perfectly that the day of the Lord so comes as a thief in the night. Hello. Who was told that Christ would come to them as a thief? Sardis. Not Philadelphia, not Laodicea. So the analogy at least has to connect in part to that. The Lord comes as a thief in the night. When they say peace and safety, everything's okay, don't worry, just go to sleep. Rock yourself back to sleep. Then sudden destruction comes upon them as labor pains upon a pregnant woman, they shall not escape. You, brethren, are not in darkness so that this day should overtake you as a thief. You're sons of light and sons of the day. We are not of the night nor the darkness. Therefore, let us not sleep as others do. Let us watch and be sober. You go back and read Sardis, and you'll see that the analogy there is the same. Luke chapter 12 as well, and verse number 35. Luke 12:35. It says, let your waist be girded and your lamps burning, and you yourselves be like men who wait for their master. That when he returns from the wedding, that he comes and knocks, that he may open to him immediately. If you're watching and he's coming, you run to the door. Blessed are those servants whom the master, when he comes, will find watching. Assuredly, I say to you that he will gird himself and have them sit down and eat and will come and serve them. He's talking about in the kingdom. And if he should come in the second watch or come in the third watch, how do we know that Sardis wasn't the first watch, Philadelphia wasn't the second, and Laodicea wasn't the third? But it was still supposed to be a watch. And some in each must be ready. And he finds them so, blessed are those servants. But know this, if the master of the house had known what hour the thief would come, he would have watched and not allowed his house to be broken into. Therefore, you be ready. For the Son of Man comes at an hour you do not expect. So you go back and you kind of look at what happened there in Accra. and they were lulled asleep in one system, and they come into another, and all of a sudden they look around, and it's kind of not what they expected. Then finally, there is a division that takes place, and the people who are dancing and singing in the Pentecostal tradition decide that they want to go back to where they came from, and they walk out the door as well. And now they're left without a resident teacher that has the background, even of the historical background of the church. They were starving out spiritually. At some point, Mr. Rhodes started actually sending tapes over so that the tapes could be played, so that men who had longer background and experience in the church could be teaching them. But you know what? Sometimes you need to talk to somebody. Sometimes you need to touch their hand. Sometimes you need to sit and ask them a question. And so they come out of malnourishment into very, very stark provisions, to be honest. And then the next thing happens is the group you're with leaves and goes as well, and now you remain. You go to Accra, and you begin to teach those people. It's like a man who is very, very hungry. In fact, he's really hungry, and you sit him down at the table, and he starts to gobble in the food. We came in one day, Dari, we hadn't had breakfast or lunch, and at least he hadn't, and we sat down, and Tone puts out some dinner, and Dari just starts shoveling it away. I said, "Dari, hello? You know, a little manners would do all right, you know?" He says, "I'm hungry, you know?" I mean, he's just shoveling away. Well, that's a craw, spiritually. You hand them a little spiritual food, and they'll take it out of your hands. "Give me that. I want some of that. I want it today." Dari and I have talked about it. It's an interesting dynamic. You know, it makes it really easy to give a sermon? Because it's not my spirit alone that allows me to teach. It's your spirit in receiving what I say that it gives me also something to connect to. When you go speak at the feast and there's 1,000 people out there praying for you to do well, yearning to be taught, believe me, the sermon takes a step up because of what God is doing. So you think Gavin knows what to say? He didn't know what to say. He said it. God knows what he wants Gavin to say. How's that? Is that better? He does. And there's no way. We don't talk. We don't need to talk. Someone says, "Well, you need to put this all together and kind of organize it." I don't want to organize it. I want God to organize it. And the people that serve God and submit themselves to him, he'll move them along the way. So it makes it kind of nice. But the fact is, you go to Accra right now, it's a very small group of people, but they are hungry for time and attention. And so, like I say, they're hoping my plane can't get off the ground or something happens, and it worked. I stayed. So life goes in a way that is, again, dramatic, miraculous. They want to be fed. You ever gone through a spiritual drought? You ever gone through a time in your life when you kind of stepped down spiritually, and then you kind of rode along the bottom for a while, and you kind of think, "Boy, when do I get out of here?" Proverbs 24 is a physical example to illustrate a spiritual principle. These things are given for our examples. All right, Proverbs 24 and verse number 30. "I went by the field of the slothful. I went by the vineyard of the man devoid of understanding. And there it was, overgrown with thorns, surface was covered with nettles, stone wall was broken down. When I saw it, I considered it well. I looked on it and I received instruction. A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest. So your poverty will come like a prowler and your want like an armed man." And the same thing happens spiritually. You will come to ruin. Psalm 42, I pointed out to Dari, and we discussed it a bit. It's almost like it was written specifically in response to the Accra congregation. But Psalm 42, "As the deer pants for the water brook, as a thirsty deer wants that freshening drink of water, so pants my soul for you, O God. My soul thirsts for God, for the living God. When shall I come and appear before God? My tears have been my food day and night, while they continually say to me, where is your God? When I remember these things, I pour out my soul within me. I used to go with the multitude. Why, there used to be 400 people in Ghana. And we used to go to the feast together, and we used to go to church together, and our children went to camp together. It says, I went with them to the house of God with a voice of joy and praise, with a multitude that kept a pilgrim feast. And where are they now? It says, I'm like a deer wanting a drink of cold water. I'm starved. Feed me. Why are you cast down, O my soul? Why are you disquieted within me? Hope in God. I shall yet praise Him for the help of His countenance. Very, very close. Acts chapter 8. There's a reason for why God put teachers in the church. There's a reason for the fact that they become accountable to God, but they need to fulfill their responsibilities in an honorable way. Acts chapter 8 and verse 26 is the story of the Ethiopian eunuch and Philip. And it says, an angel of the Lord spoke to Philip, saying, rise and go toward the south along the road which goes down from Jerusalem to Gaza. This is desert. And he arose and went, and behold, a man of Ethiopia, a eunuch of great authority under Candace, the queen of the Ethiopians, who had charge of all her treasury, had come to Jerusalem to worship. He was returning. And sitting in his chariot, he was reading Isaiah the prophet. And the Spirit said to Philip, go and overtake his chariot. Philip ran to him and heard him reading the prophet Isaiah. He says, do you understand what you're reading? And he says, how can I unless someone guides me? He says, I need to be taught. Okay? He asked Philip to come and sit with him. And the place in the scripture he was reading was this. He was led as a sheep to the slaughter, like a lamb silent to its shear before its shearer, so he opened not his mouth. In his humiliation, his justice was taken away, and who will declare his generation, for his life was taken from the earth. And Philip stopped and pointed him to Jesus Christ. And my guess is he really liked what he heard. It made sense. And he compared it to whatever it was in Ethiopia that was in his own background. But Philip here explained to him the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. He says, how will I know if somebody doesn't guide me? So let me say just a little bit about being guided. A teacher in the church, when he guides someone, is supposed to point them to God. He is not supposed to set up a personal following or point them to himself. And that's why we use the words of God here, not some man's opinion, supposedly, when we teach. That's what we're supposed to do. So when Daria and I were in Ghana in January, as we went out to the churches of these pastors, and the pastors would tell us as we walked up, now, don't say anything about the problems in the church to the members. I haven't said a thing. And we looked at them, excuse me? We are here to tell the members about the problems and to explain what is taking place so that they will understand. Now, they're not going to tell us we can't say that, and so we did. But pastor after pastor, not every single one, but a number of them, as we came to their congregation that evening, said, now, I haven't said anything to them. Don't say anything about the troubles. And we had to remind each one of those that is why we are here. You see, the pastors had actually set up those congregations, or at least allowed the process to play out to where the congregations would follow them. That was the process. And it was obvious. It was so obvious to me. So we had our meeting on Sunday, and all the pastors were there, and Daria and I, and I warned the pastors. I said, these people are following you personally. And it has been set up in such a way where they are dependent on you. They speak Twi, you speak English. The literature is in English, so if you don't tell them, they won't know. And I said, you're not telling them what's going on. You're not letting them understand the dynamic. You're feeding them selectively what you want them to hear. I said, that is way, way too much power in your hands, and you need to be using that in an honorable manner. And I openly confronted the pastors about those issues. after we were gone, one of the pastors went back to his congregation, and he told them that the United Church of God didn't want them anymore. That's what he told them. Didn't want them anymore. You know, shades of Latin America. People were told that they weren't wanted anymore. The same pastor actually went and told his congregation, and by the way, I haven't been paid. He had. Actually, in advance, and for a number of months in advance, but he wanted to double dip. Now, I'm not saying that because he did that, that that was somehow credentialed by the system, but it was just one more way to assert personal control, and it was an abomination. So he collected a little bit from his congregations to help double dip on his salary, and when they didn't give him enough, he went back and he asked them again. Now, the fact is, some of those people have connections into Accra, and the members in Accra who understood and knew that passed back to them, well, just so you know. I don't know how all those things will play out. Nobody would want that in any organization, but the fact is, that's what we found out on this trip. Galatians 6. You know, everybody in the Church of God is not here for the same reason. And everybody in the Church of God doesn't even see the same things. But there is accountability. Galatians 6 and verse number 6. Let him who is taught the word share in all good things with him who teaches. Okay, so we have ministry that are paid in order to minister. Not paid to be servants, just paid, I mean obviously they're supposed to be, but they're paid to be able to function pastorally and dedicate their time. But do not be deceived. God is not mocked. Whatever a man sows, that will he also reap. He who reaps to his flesh will of the flesh reap corruption. He who sows to the Spirit will of the Spirit reap everlasting life. Again, sad to say, the circumstance that I just described to you is not particularly an isolated example. When Mr. Rhodes was over there in some of the French-speaking regions, speaking to the members, getting a translator, finding someone who could translate back and forth in French to English. And he went to the Republic of Benin. When I say Benin in Nigeria, it's actually Benin City. It's a congregation in that place. If I say Benin as a nation, it's the neighboring country to Nigeria on the west. There's Benin, Togo, and Ghana. It's not a very big place in that respect. You drive from here to Missoula, you just went from Accra to Lagos, all right? And they're narrow countries, but obviously the borders are complex. When we bring the young people, the children over for the camp, we have to, can I say, we have to pay their way. We have to pay their way across the borders, or they don't come. And so I left funds behind that were a gift to make sure that the children that are coming had the means to have supervision and to bring them to camp in that way. I paid for the generator. When they had the fire, one of the young men took the generator and tossed it off the top of the third story because it had a tank of gasoline in it. So we bought another generator. I told him, I'm sorry I wasn't there. I'd have helped you out. But the fact is, we with gifts as well, replaced the generator for the church. So some of the things that people have helped to contribute, I just want you to know, I don't come back and always say, well, I did this and I did that and I did something else. But it goes to good purpose. Anyway, Mr. Rhodes went to Benin to visit the members there. And Dari came across from Lagos. He talked to Dari, and Dari and I had been there in Ghana, so he wanted to connect with Dari. Dari came across from Lagos. And you know what they found? That the members in Benin are 1.5 hours from Dari's house. 1.5 hours. Closer than me going to Lewiston this morning, all right? Time-wise. And the members in Benin speak Yoruba. That's Dari's native tongue. They speak a village version of the Yoruba compared to the city, but Dari understands it and can speak it. It's just a slightly different version of the exact same language. And it was more convenient eventually for Mr. Rhodes to use Dari to translate from the Benin brethren in Yoruba to English to him. What Dari found out was, the brethren in Benin have been asking for years, aren't there people around here that we could be with or fellowship with? Aren't we could maybe be at the feast or do some things, our children? Isn't there anybody around? They never got an answer to their question. They were shocked that Dari lives an hour and a half away and speaks the same language. Dari was shocked because they'd never been put in contact with him. Because they didn't want them to be in contact with him. That's the facts. Hour and a half. No contact over the years. Well, Cameroon's on the other side of Nigeria, speaks French. Similar circumstances. Fortunately, Dari has contact and relationship there. The fact is, over the years, in the United Church of God, in places in Asia, in places in French-speaking areas, and in places in Spanish-speaking areas, it was the same way. They were set up to follow a man. They were set up to be dependent on a man translating for them what he wanted them to hear. And if the man's intentions are good, then they get good things. And if the man's intentions are slanted, then they only hear what the man wants them to hear, and they only hear what he wants to say. Information was filtered down, and it was directed in one way. Now, you don't know all that until you go out, then you travel around, you talk to a few people, and you see what happened. Jeremiah 23 is a warning. It's a very strong warning. It's referring to the Jews, physically, Israel in a greater sense, but spiritually, obviously, we are the sheep of God's pasture, and Jesus Christ is the chief shepherd. But notice Jeremiah 23, it says, "Woe to the shepherds who destroy and scatter the sheep of my pasture, says the Lord. Therefore, thus says the Lord God of Israel against the shepherds who feed my people. You have scattered my flock, driven them away, and not attended to them. Behold, I will attend to you for the evil of your doings." That is a very strong warning for the responsibility that the shepherds are supposed to take in caring for God's people in that way. So I want to go then back again to Sardis and Philadelphia and Laodicea. And I want to look at some of the scriptures that lay out maybe a little more directly how God is going to deal with each. I am not assuming that these scriptures do not have broad application, but I am assuming, based on what is symbolized, that they are more directed toward the elements of those groups that are according to the description. Malachi 3, and verse number 16. I will start out in the broadest way in terms of God sparing His children, caring for His people. Malachi 3:16. "Those who feared the Lord spoke to one another, and the Lord listened and heard them. And a book of remembrance was written before Him for those who fear the Lord and who meditate on His name. They shall be mine, says the Lord of hosts, on the day that I make them my jewels, and I will spare them as a man spares his own child who serves him. Then you shall again discern between the righteous and the wicked, between the one who serves God and the one who does not serve Him." So in the broadest sense, God is going to spare His people who are dedicated and serve Him fully in humility. Right? Okay? So let's look at Philadelphia, Revelation 3 and verse number 9. I'll start there. When it talks about what God is going to do for Philadelphia, in terms of the trouble and trials to come on all the earth. Revelation 3, verse 9, says, "I will make those of the synagogue of Satan who say they are Jews and are not," referencing, obviously, some of those who put themselves forward back in this time as part of the church, were not in the church for the same reason. And they were not serving the same master. Now, this is a prophecy as well. All I'm saying is, that's what's referenced here. They lie. "Indeed, I'll make them come and worship before your feet and to know that I have loved you. Because you have kept my command to persevere, I also will keep you from the hour of trial which will come upon the whole earth to test those who dwell on the earth." So Philadelphia is told that they will be kept from the tribulation, the hour of trial that will test the whole earth. OK, Okay, Daniel 7, let's look at something specifically there. Not everyone is going to be kept from the trial that comes on the whole earth. Now, I understand, and I've addressed it before in previous sermons, that there are righteous people who are going to be martyred and suffer that extreme, that ultimate consequence of their faith. So I'm not going to deny that. I think that's clearly biblical. But in terms of addressing the different attitudes between Sardis, Philadelphia, and Laodicea, just notice what the Bible actually says. Daniel 7, verse number 25. Speaking of here, the other horn, and it references above the ten horns. I'm not trying to go through the prophecy, but this is in reference now to the church. He shall speak pompous words against the Most High, shall persecute the saints of the Most High, shall intend to change times and law, and the saints will be given into his hand for a time and times and half a time. So the saints that are given into his hand for 3.5 years are not the same saints that are protected from the hour trial to come on the whole earth. They're not the same group. They would be in direct conflict. So go to Revelation 12, and you see this then broken out into two parts. But verse 13 of Revelation 12. Now we're looking at Laodicea. It says, when the dragon saw that he had been cast to the earth, he persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child. The woman who was given two wings of a great eagle, this is not Laodicea here, goes from the attitude described in Philadelphia to the attitude portrayed in Laodicea. So that she might fly into the wilderness to her place, she is nourished for a time, times, and half a time from the presence of the serpent, kept from the hour of trial on the earth, all right? There's a group that is kept from the hour of trial. The serpent spewed water out of his mouth like a flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away by the flood. The earth helped the woman, opened its mouth, swallowed up the flood which the dragon spewed out of his mouth. And the dragon was enraged with the woman, and he went to make war with the rest of her offspring, with those who remains, another group, another element here. Notice, they keep the commandments of God, they have the testimony of Jesus Christ. It doesn't say they're asleep, it doesn't say they're dead, it says they actually know the truth. But you see, they're self-righteous, and they're judgmental. They have the testimony, they have the commandments, but they're proud of it, and they lord over others in comparisons. We are the only ones, you are not. They beat their breast spiritually, so to speak. And so there's a group then that would be Laodicea by description. What about Sardis? Where's the reference to how God's going to deal with Sardis? I think that's fascinating, Matthew 25. See, what we're looking for then under Sardis is somebody who went to sleep. Somebody who was dying and had to wake up, because that's the portrayal of what Sardis is. Matthew 25 and verse number 1. I have to say, I've not looked at this before in this light, clearly. But it says, the kingdom of heaven shall be likened to 10 virgins who took the lamps and went out to meet the bridegroom. 5 were wise and 5 were foolish. You see, there are some in Sardis who kept their garments. I'm not saying this is limited to Sardis. I'm saying the thread of analogy is equal to what Sardis and how Sardis is described. It says, those who were foolish took their lamps and no oil with them. The wise took oil into vessels and no lamps. While the bridegroom was delayed, they all slumbered and slept. And at midnight a cry was heard, behold, the bridegroom is coming, go out and meet him. All the virgins arose and trimmed their lamps. The foolish said to the wise, give us some of your oil, our lamps are going out. And the wise answered and said, no, lest there not be enough for us, go to those who sell and buy for yourselves. When they went to buy, the bridegroom came. Those who were ready went in with him to the wedding. The door was shut. Afterward, the other virgins came and said, Lord, open to us. And he said and answered, I say to you, I do not know you. Watch. Goes right back to the same analogy. Watch, therefore. You do not know the day or the hour in which the Son of Man is coming. The analogy is just too close to at least not take it into account. Romans 13. And verse number 8. He goes back before it begins to speak about awaking from sleep. We're still talking about the attitude now and perspective of Sardis. And it says what it is that we should be doing, and that's loving one another, right? That's the basic issue. By this all men will know that you are my disciples if you have love one for another. Whether you're Sardis or Philadelphia or Laodicea, if you'll come out and have love one for another, then that's going to be the key that shows that you're on the right track. Owe no one anything except to love one another, for he who loves another has fulfilled the law. The commandments, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, not steal, not bear false witness, not covet. If there is any other commandment, are all summed up in this saying, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no harm to a neighbor, therefore love is the fulfillment of the law. And do this, knowing the time that now it's high time to awake out of sleep. Philadelphia is not told to wake up. Laodicea is not told to wake up. Sardis is. And now our salvation is nearer than when we first believed. The night is far spent, the day is at hand. Therefore, let us cast off the works of darkness. Let us put on the armor of light. Let us walk properly as in the day, not in revelry and drunkenness, not in licentiousness or lewdness, nor in strife and envy. Put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision for the flesh to fulfill its lusts. I think it is amazing, God addressing the issues to each one in various ways. As I said, not everyone in the Church of God is there for the same reason. Not everyone in the Church of God, even spiritually, seems to be able to see the same things. And we're not going to be able to just do whatever it is that everybody is doing around us. That's simply not good enough. Read the words, these words, God's words. Do what God says. Now, where man tells you or says or argues or disputes, just read these words and do these things. That's the basis. And quite frankly, brethren, each of us is going to have to assess ourselves, whether we exemplify Sardis or Philadelphia or Laodicea. There's other choices, but those are the principal ones that God portrays coming up to the end. Each of those groups will exist, each of those attitudes will exist, and each one of us is going to have to assess before God where we stand in doing these things.